Now it's on. Go ahead now.
We will go ahead and start the Committee on Agriculture and Rural Economies. Today is Thursday, January 27th, and today we have with us for presentations, we have the Minnesota Agricultural and Rural Leadership, the MARL program, and with that program, we'll have Mr. Joel Mathewitz and Ms. Shelley Shield be making a presentation, and then after that, we will have a presentation from the University of Minnesota. And we'll have Dr. Trevor Ames, the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Beverly Durgan, the Dean of the Extension, and Dr. Ellen Levine, the Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resources. So to start with, if the MARL program folks could come up to the table, we would appreciate it. Mr. Mathewitz and Ms. Scheel, when you get situated, if you'd go ahead and announce yourselves and your titles for the record, and then start with your presentation. And welcome, and we appreciate your coming today.
Thank you, Chairman Dames. I'm Joel Mathewitz. I'm from Morgan, Redwood County, and in the Senator Dames District.
Chairman, members, I'm Shelley Schell from the City of Altura.
Thank you, and go ahead with your presentation if you're ready.
Yes, thank you, Chairman and members. We appreciate the opportunity to just come here today and describe a little bit about MARL, Minnesota Agriculture and Rural Leadership. We did pass out a handout there that is kind of a fact sheet and a broad overview of our organization. We were founded in 2000, and it's a two-year cohort program where we select participants from across the state of Minnesota to go through a leadership training course. Class 6 is in the room here today with us, as they may have met with you earlier today as well. So we've had 6 classes. Each class is comprised of 30 to 32 participants. Two-thirds are egg producers. The other third could be an agribusiness across the state. The whole purpose of our organization is to provide a skill set and additional tools for our rural leaders to be more involved within their communities and take a more active role in policy development. They will meet 45 days over a two-year period. They'll do 9 in-state sessions across the state of Minnesota to learn about the diverse aspects of our industry, going up to Duluth and Bemidji and Moorhead and Rochester and Marshall and St. Cloud and Windham, so they get to see all the different aspects of agriculture around the state. They also will spend a little bit of time out in Washington, D.C., and then each class will also have an international experience. I am an alum of the program as part of Class 4, and I had the great fortune to spend 2 weeks in South Africa. So getting to see the dynamics of policy and agriculture in another country definitely gives a whole new perspective to how fortunate we are here in Minnesota and the things we have. We are a public-private partnership. MARL is unique. We do treat ourselves as a nonprofit, but we do partner with the University of Minnesota Extension. Our program leader comes through the Extension Service. We also partner with SMSU out in Marshall, and our executive director is housed there. So both universities are very supportive and help with our program. But we do fundraising privately. The cost of the program is anywhere from $12,000 to $15,000 per participant. We ask each participant to pay a third, so about $4,800. They will pay for their tuition to be a part of this class, and the rest of it is done through fundraising through our alumni and corporate partners. With that, I want to introduce Shelley. Shelley is in the current class, Class 6, and she'll just talk a little bit more about some of the sessions they're experiencing right now.
Thank you, Chairman, members. I am Shelley Shell, and I'm from Altura, Monona County. And my husband and our sons, we own a Century Family Farm. My husband is also a practicing dairy veterinarian, and I personally work with both pork and dairy producers in the animal health industry. I'm very excited and honored to be a part of the MARL program. I see it myself as a leader in both my community as well as in animal agriculture. And I see the MARL program as an opportunity to work with my classmates, alumni, and state leaders to find areas of commonality among the various sectors of agriculture, whether it be crop production or forestry or animal agriculture, even aquaculture, to find ways that we can do unique and collaborative efforts to enhance and improve the dialogue with our consumers and increase the understanding mutually. So far in my experience, I have been just struck with the opportunity to be exposed to a diversity of perspectives within our class and with our speakers. And it has really challenged me to take a more encompassing approach when I am formulating my ideas and opinions. And that, I think, will only lead to positive outcomes in my actions and our collaborative actions moving forward. The ultimate outcome is we care very sincerely for our environment, for our animals, and for ultimately providing a safe and healthful food supply for the world. I want to thank you for the opportunity, and I sincerely appreciate you taking the time to understanding agriculture and its impact on the vitality of our rural communities.
Well, thank you. Are there any questions by the committee members for Mr. Mathewitz or Ms. Schell? Mr. Mathewitz, can you give me some idea how many number of folks you've had go through your program as far as, I don't know if you call them graduates or just what your terminology is?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, Marl, like I said, was established in 2000, and we'd usually take a class around 30 or 32 on a biennium type program. So we are in class 6, so that puts us about 150, 156 graduates of the Marl program that are involved utilizing our Marl network and utilizing resources that we can learn from each other. So class 6 is a new group of 32. This is their third session that they are currently partaking in, and like I said, they'll be going through next May will be their graduation.
Thank you. What type of qualifications or background or experience are, how do you choose your participants or your members for each class?
Absolutely. Each group, we do ask for nominations either from our alumni or corporate sponsors. And so there is a nomination process or an application process, so each participant does apply. So there is a lengthy application that talks about their community involvement, their leadership, and what they hope to gain from this program. They'll also go through an interview process. For this class 6, I believe we had in the mid-60s as far as applications, and we selected a class of 32.
Thank you. You were talking earlier about your international experiences. You go to different countries. What when you do that, what type of things do you pursue when you're in these foreign countries as far as agriculture? What all types of different programs do you look at when you're there or try to participate in or get involved in?
On that one, Mr. Chairman, I'll just talk from personal experience. Being an alum of the program, I was a part of Class 4, and I had the great fortune to tour South Africa. And so through our class experience, we tried to tour different production facilities, processing facilities, and also talk with some of the policymakers there to understand how their government and their processes work as far as imports and exports and environmental issues, a lot of the same things that we may be dealing with here, and understanding that we are in a global market. And for our case, or the experience I had, just understanding the importance of policy. South Africa has totally different dynamics, and they have some real challenging issues that they're going to be faced with as far as land rights and access to markets. And so it really gives you an appreciation to some of the things that we do have here here in Minnesota, and it just makes you appreciate that and gives you a broader perspective on the importance of good policy and allowing our producers and processors to have the freedom to do the right thing for our consumers.
Thank you. Any other senators have any other questions for Mr. Mathewitz or Ms. Schell? If hearing none, thank you very much for the presentation. Thank you very much for coming, and we appreciate your board members and stuff attending today. And we wish you luck, and thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman and members. Appreciate it.
Next, we'll have Dr. Trevor Ames, the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Durgan, the Dean of the Extension, and Dr. Levine, the Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resources, do their presentation. They have requested that we hold questions until after their presentation, so when they get set up here, we'll be all set to go. And for the record, if you would introduce yourselves and state your position.
Good afternoon. Chair and committee members. My name is Bev Durgan. I'm Dean of University of Minnesota Extension and Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station.
I'm Alan Levine. I'm the Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences.
Good afternoon. I'm Trevor Ames, the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine.
Thank you. And if you are ready, if you want to go ahead with your presentation, we would appreciate it.
Okay, I will go ahead and get started. It's a pleasure for myself to be here and my two colleagues, Dr. Levine and Dr. Ames, to speak with you today about research, education, and extension at the University of Minnesota. I think all of you know that agriculture is really a shining star in the Minnesota economy right now, that agriculture and all of agriculture, not only production agriculture, but the processing and distribution of food, is the second largest employer in Minnesota. And every agricultural production job in Minnesota supports an additional 1.5 other positions within the economy. Also, agriculture is a major driver of Minnesota's economy. We have over $15 billion in livestock and crop sales in Minnesota. Minnesota is also a large exporter of agricultural products with over $5 billion exported yearly. Minnesota is the second largest agricultural producer in the U.S., and it's the seventh largest agricultural exporter in the U.S. So what we'd like to talk to you about today is how we use the money provided by the Minnesota Agricultural State Special and how our three colleges support agriculture and the rural economy. The Ag State Special funds research and extension at the St. Paul campus, but also throughout the state. And as you can see on the map, our many locations throughout the state. The Ag State Special leverages other outside funds to work on problems of agriculture and rural communities. And it leverages at any one time between four and five times the amount of money of the state special. The money is used to support production and protects our food supply. And also the Ag State Special funding is used to create economic activity in every county of the state. For those, I think many of you are familiar with the Ag State Special, but I thought I would just summarize it briefly here. The Ag State Special is a special appropriation within the University of Minnesota's budget. The Ag State Special is broken into two parts. One is for the support of research, which is 65% of the funding, and the other is 35% of the funding goes in support of University of Minnesota Extension. As I mentioned, the Ag State Special provides the core funding for our three colleges to provide research and education in the area of farm productivity, food safety, air and water quality, our animal and plant disease prevention, educating the next generation, and responding to crises both for agriculture and for rural communities. Just to talk a little bit about the funding of the Ag State Special, the Ag State Special funding has been tied to the economy of the state. As you can see, in 2008 and 2009, we had an increase in the state special over that biennium. However, last year, because of the challenges with the economy of the state, you can see that we did see a decrease in the funding of the Ag State Special. And currently, the funding of the Ag State Special is at the level that it was in 1990. What I'd like to do now is just talk a little bit about some of the programs within the Agricultural Experiment Station and Extension, some of our key programs in supporting Minnesota agriculture. As I mentioned earlier, Minnesota is a large exporter of agricultural products, one of those being soybeans. Our faculty at the University of Minnesota conducts a statewide and nationwide survey on soybean quality and production. That information is used to educate Minnesota soybean growers about the importance of quality soybeans, but it also a report is used with companies that are looking to export our soybeans, especially to the Asian countries of Japan and Taiwan. Also, some recent research by our extension and research faculty on DDGs, the dry grain distillers from byproduct of ethanol, that research is supporting an increase in export of these DDGs. Also, the experiment station releases many soybean varieties that are food-grade varieties and organic varieties that help, again, to increase the export of food-grade soybeans. The University of Minnesota is very fortunate to have some very high quality research facilities. Two of these facilities is an insect quarantine facility and our plant pathogen facility. Both of these facilities were funded in part with funding from the state legislature. These two facilities support our research and extension program in controlling pathogens such as the soybean aphid, buckthorn, and garlic mustard. Also, our plant quarantine facility is supporting our research in rust resistance and soybean rust and in sudden death oak wilt. And sorry about the slides. They're kind of moving around here a little bit. Also, the experiment station and extension, we are very proud of our program in releasing crop varieties that are used throughout the state. We've just released a new wheat variety that's a high-quality variety in both in yield, protein, and in disease resistant. Our extension faculty work closely with producers in determining the best place for these varieties to be grown in Minnesota. We've released a new barley variety. As I mentioned, we also have a large program in soybeans. And I think many of you are familiar with our horticulture program with our release of apples, grapes, and some of our cold hardy shrubs. Our three cold hardy grape varieties are supporting an increasing enterprise in wineries and vineyards throughout the state, and I know we have one of those producers in the audience here that is benefiting from the release of these cold hardy grapes, and we're very proud of those. Also, University of Minnesota Extension is committed to protecting our water resources in the state. We have extension programs anywhere from managing drainage and runoff from agricultural fields, runoff from urban and lake shores, and also testing of salt tolerance. I've recently learned of a new program that we have working with the Department of Transportation on salt runoff from how to prevent salt runoff from roads into many of our areas where we have water and storm drainage. Also, dairy is an important industry in the state. We work closely with the Minnesota milk producers and MDA in supporting the dairy industry of this state. As you know, the dairy industry has been hit quite hard by the economic turndown in Minnesota. So we're working, all three of our colleges are working on providing financial analysis for these dairies and also looking at ways that they can increase production to work through this economic times. Pork industry is another major industry in the state and also an industry that has a lot of exports out of the state. We have worked very closely with eradicating diseases within our pork industry. And also, as I mentioned, the Ag State Special funding helps our faculty to provide research and extension in supporting the pork industry. But it also, they're able to use this funding to leverage outside money in support of their work. We've just recently received a large federal grant from the National Institute of Food and Agriculture in supporting the work for the pork industry in the state. University of Minnesota Extension has a long history in providing financial expertise and education for our producers in the state. We also have a program that we work very closely with bankers and ag lenders that provide financing for our growers. Our Center for Farm Financial Management is known nationwide in the products that they produce to help with financial management for our producers. Also, University of Minnesota Extension is not only committed to production agriculture, but we're also committed to rural communities. And one of our programs is the Horizons Program, which is being funded by the Northwest Area Foundation. The Horizon Programs has worked with 34 rural towns. These are towns that are less than 5,000 in population and with 10% of their population living in poverty. We're working to build the human capital and the capacity of those towns to determine what their future is, for them to help retain businesses and also retain the residents of those particular towns. We also know that there's been lots of conversations recently about it's important to find new jobs in Minnesota. We also believe it's important to maintain the jobs that we have here in Minnesota. Our business expansion and retention program has worked with over 60 communities to help those communities find ways to retain businesses and expand businesses in those communities and keep the local dollars in those communities. Organic and sustainable agriculture also is an increasingly important part of agriculture in the state of Minnesota and in the U.S. We've recently, working with the College of Ag, have converted part of the dairy at the West Central Research and Outreach Center to an organic dairy. Our release of soybean varieties has made Minnesota the number one producer of organic soybeans in the nation. We also have started a program in farm-to-school programs connecting local farmers with school districts. One other program that we are very proud of in extension is our programs on building human capital and leadership. You've heard from the Morrow program this morning. This is a program that we're very proud to be a partner in. We also have a program in the Red River Valley. We work with other agencies to build the leadership within their agencies. And also one of our longstanding programs for leadership within youth is our 4-H youth development programs. Our 4-H programs have a long history in Minnesota. These are county-based programs serving local needs. Currently, we have over 126,000 youth that are involved in our 4-H and youth development programs. We have over 10,000 volunteers that actively volunteer in this program and support our program. We also have a fairly new program called Operation Military Kids that work with our military families and work with the youth of these families when their parents are deployed with them, helping them deal with the issues of being a military family. Also, we have a program where we train other youth workers in the state, over 4,300 youth workers. These are the people and the adults that work with the Boys and Girls Clubs, the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, and we help train those leaders for good youth practices and how to work with youth. Also within the Agricultural State Special, we have funding called the Agricultural Rapid Response Fund. This was legislative funding within the State Special. This funding really is directed at solving short-term problems that agricultural and rural communities are facing. We've used this funding to solve some problems with plant diseases, animal diseases, and also in crop production. Finally, in closing, I would just like to say again that the Ag State Special is the funding we use to provide the base funding for our faculty, and it also is the funding that allows us to respond to many disasters that happen in the state, both to agriculture and at the local level, things like floods and rains, our drought, as you know, that there's predictions for a potential large flood again in the Red River Valley of Minnesota. We're working with North Dakota State University and other agencies to help prepare for that flood in that area when it comes. So with that, I just want to thank you. I look forward to our discussions, and I will go ahead and turn the conversation over to Dr. Al Levine.
Thank you, Dr. Durgan. We appreciate your presentation.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, sorry I have a cold. I usually don't sound like this. Thanks so much for the opportunity. This is a tremendous opportunity for us to talk to you about our programs. So the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences focuses on four areas which are really trying to manage our landscapes for sustainability, diversity, and productivity in food and ag systems, in biodiversity, in bioeconomy, in global and climate environmental change. We're working hard to integrate all these areas. We've been in a unique position to do so, partially because of the fact that we were combined. When I became the dean, there were three colleges or unit from one college and two colleges that came together, and we have a fairly large college devoted to these efforts. We have 11 departments, and we have 30 campus-based interdisciplinary centers. We have research and outreach centers throughout the state, which give us another opportunity to do long-term agricultural research and research that's relevant to the state. These centers, because we have three biomes with different soil types, we also have a forest in Cloquet, one of the few research forests in the country. that's been devoted for many years, 100 years, towards this effort, as well as the agricultural community, doing work that could not be done in a laboratory. This is our living laboratory. It's extremely important for our faculty to do their research. As far as the undergraduate school, we have around 1,850 undergraduates. We have 14 majors and 22 minors. And we have 700 graduate students that participate in 13 different programs, five of which are integrated across the university, such as nutrition, that is in part of the School of Public Health and the medical school as well. We're revitalizing our program. We have to keep ourselves relevant. We keep on getting more and more students, and we want to make sure we're relevant. And we have 240 faculty. About half of those faculty have appointments associated with research efforts. And the state special really helps those faculty go out. First, they get their salary paid. But secondly, importantly, they go out and compete for very difficult grants to get. For example, those USDA grants that you see there for $36 million and the NSF and NIH, their pay lines were 5% or 10% of the grants got funded, which means we have very, very competitive faculty who are doing very well. We have about $75 million in these grants, and it creates 600 jobs for the state. You can see that more and more students are seeking agricultural careers in different ways than they did before, but our largest major with the most students is animal science, followed by nutrition, and those areas continue to grow dramatically. We have a lot of interest in environmental sciences as it relates to agriculture, so we continue to try to revitalize this curriculum and make it relevant to the current group of people. We really raise a group of students who are tremendous leaders. Our students succeed. Princess K's, livestock and judging teams, food product development team, ag professional societies, and four of the six state officers are U of M students in FFA. So we're involved in creating that next generation of leaders and agricultural literacy for students and for our community. When we surveyed students, we found that 83% of our students found a job within 6 months of graduating. I had somebody who trained in my laboratory. He's in psychology. It took him 100 letters before he could get a job somewhere in the country. Our students get these jobs very quickly with a mean salary of $36,000. So clearly the agricultural sector needs people, and we're involved in raising those students and educating them. Now, one of the primary areas of importance for all of us sitting at this table is keeping a healthy food system. Also a safe and healthy food system. And we have scientists that are working on coliform diseases, on E. coli in foods. We have people in extension who go throughout the state and train folks on how to handle food and how to do it properly. And the National Center for Food Protection and Defense, which is in the College of Veterinary Medicine and works together with the School of Public Health, we also have faculty that work with that. So this has been a great opportunity. Our university is involved in tracking a lot of the diseases that have occurred over the last number of years in foodborne illness. We also are very interested in food and health. We all hear about the fact that agricultural food, that our food contributes, the way we produce it, the way we sell it, contributes to such things as obesity and diabetes. We're working heavily in childhood obesity, in obese pregnant women, in obesity in general. We have a Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives initiative that the president of the university funded and goes across the whole university. And we have a food industry center in applied economics, and that food industry center helps our large number of food businesses that are present in this state. You know, we're one of the most populated areas in terms of food business. You heard from Dean Durgan about our unique facilities. We've done a lot of work in terms of working on durable rust resistance in wheat and other cereals. We're working on UG99. We're identifying resistance in cultivated and wild barley. We're deeply involved in a metococcal, which is alfalfa, but a model plant in terms of genomics. We work on genomics. We work on proteomics, which is the protein. And more recently, we hired some folks in metabolomics. There's omics everywhere. In fact, there's a magazine called Omics. The metabolomics is really looking at the metabolites, either in animals or in plants, and how we can produce safer and healthier foods from that. Many of you must have heard about Marla Spivak. She won the MacArthur Genius Award. She has the only laboratory, bee laboratory, in the five-state area. She has done tremendous work on looking at safety of bees and producing genetically viable varieties of bees. She's been very interested, and we funded some projects on propolis, which is a compound that the bees produce to keep their hives antimicrobial. And it's been shown to, even in a petri dish, to affect AIDS virus. So this is a very interesting compound that bees, and there's people all over the world who ingest this thinking that they're going to protect themselves. So we're trying to find out if that really does work. We've been working in the area of ethanol and biodiesel byproducts, as well as a variety of other energy systems. We hired a series of investigators in fungal biology because the lignocellular parts in woody plants and trees and woody ornamentals and other kinds of woody plants, lignin is the primary substance that is very difficult to break down to make biofuels from. And so we have folks that are working on the enzyme systems. It takes more than one enzyme to break that down, and we've hired a series of folks in that. And it seems to be working very well. And also we've been working on algae, because algae could be used for biodiesel through their lipid content. Finally, I'd just like to mention one of our outreach centers up in Morris, Research and Outreach Centers, has put in a new facility, and we'll see how this all goes, in terms of using an old methodology to do something very new, which is to take wind and turn it into anhydrous fertilizer, anhydrous ammonia. That would be quite spectacular to be able to do that. I think you can see that our college is deeply involved in very innovative technologies and innovative learning. We're doing our best to keep agriculture in the state of Minnesota alive and well. Thanks so much. And I'd like to introduce at this point my colleague, Dean Ames.
Thank you, Dr. Levine.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, as stated, I'm Trevor Ames, the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, and it's my pleasure to be here today and tell you about some of the research at the Veterinary College, as well as some of our programs. At the Veterinary College, we support the land-grant mission of the University of Minnesota, and we feel that it's our duty to keep the animals, the economy, and the people of Minnesota healthy. I know I speak for all of the deans when I tell you about our strong support of agriculture and that we all care greatly for the success of our agricultural producers. I think Dean Durgan did a good job of talking about the importance of agriculture in the state, and certainly animal agriculture plays a big role in that. Within the college, we have a strong commitment to limiting diseases that affect animals, production-limiting diseases that affect livestock, diseases that limit our markets, our export markets, or diseases that perhaps restrict the demand or decrease the demand for products, and also diseases that affect our wildlife and companion animals. And by dealing with these diseases, we help protect the livestock industry and also the jobs associated with it, and improve animal welfare. The college is also involved in protecting the health of Minnesotans by assuring the safety of their food supply, or at least that coming of animal origin. We do a lot of research in biomedical science, using animal models to study human diseases, benefiting both animals and humans. We also do a lot of research on infectious diseases, especially those diseases that can move between animals and humans. And by keeping the animals of the state healthy, both wildlife and companion animals, I think that we increase the quality of life and increase the psychological and physical well-being of the citizens. Pet ownership is supposed to increase life expectancy by 7 years, so there's not a lot of things that do that. With the governor challenging members of the media to swallow minnows, I think we may have a new food safety challenge that we have to deal with in the future. The Veterinary College is a four-year program that most of the students that enter the program already have a four-year degree, but they can complete their undergraduate work in 3 years. Our students are in college, as I said, for 4 years. The first three are preclinical, the last is the clinical year. In order to stay accredited as an accredited veterinary school, it's important that we provide clinical training in all species, including food animals, and that is a challenge that I'll talk about in a minute. Many of our graduates go on to get additional training in graduate programs or internships or residencies. Together with the School of Public Health, we offer a joint degree program, DVM-MPH program. So, believe it or not, we have 53 of our 380 students that are actually working on two degrees at the same time. And this program, because much of it is online or offered at a summer institute, we have 60 students from other veterinary schools also enrolled in this program. And we have graduate student programs that currently we have 83 students enrolled in. Well, I mentioned the challenge of making sure that our students get enough good clinical exposure for food animal experience. And so the college has utilized public-private partnerships with teaching farms in order to achieve this. And these teaching farms are large-scale operations that provide full access to commercially operated farms. It gives us the facility and capacity that would be very difficult to duplicate on the University of Minnesota campus. Our students get closely integrated into routine activities on the farm. And as well, they can access all stages of production on the farm, as well as be involved in all forms of treatment and disease management. And the most important thing is on any given day when they are on these teaching farms, they have more than adequate educational material for their time. So they are able to get their hands on a lot of animals and maximize their learning. The educational facility that we have at New Sweden, Minnesota, in partnership with the Davis Family Farms is maybe the one that's the best known. And this facility has educational facilities, research facilities, treatment facilities of size and quality that we can also put on a lot of continuing education programs for veterinarians. And since it opened in September of 2008, we've put on 20 to 25 three-day modules for veterinarians from around the nation learning about managing dairy conditions. So I have a similar moving slide phenomena as well here. So there is a challenge with getting adequate food animal veterinarians into rural Minnesota, really into rural America. And there was a large study that was conducted in 2005 that said that veterinary schools needed to do a better job of recruiting, mentoring, training, and incentivizing students to go out into food animal practice. And I think our college, together with the partners in this room, have done a good job of addressing these challenges. In conjunction with the Department of Animal Science in Dr. Levine's college, we have one of the oldest and one of the most successful early admission programs for food animal interested students. We call it VetFast, or Veterinary Food Animal Scholar Track. And we had 23 students apply to be considered last fall, and we accepted 10 students into this year's freshman class. Our admissions process makes use of behavioral interviews, so we don't just go on grades. We also go on interpersonal skills, and that gives students from rural communities a chance to show their abilities. We have very strong mentoring and orientation programs that make use of our great food animal faculty. And then with our food animal teaching farms that I described and our faculty, we feel like we can prepare these students so that they can succeed in rural communities. And then the last point is the Minnesota Rural Veterinary Loan Forgiveness Program that was put into law in 2009. This program has provided funding for three veterinarians to stay in rural communities. It's a program that will help pay some of their loans if they stay in a rural community working more than 50% of their time on food animals. and have to, they'll get the full benefit of the program if they stay in that area for more than 3 years, or sorry, up to 5 years. So we're hoping that this loan forgiveness program, the funding can be renewed again this biennium, because I think it provides a very important incentive for students to go into these rural areas. We also have a strong emphasis on training public health veterinarians. I alluded to our DVM MPH program. We also have other training programs, including a public health residency. But these public health veterinarians play an important role in dealing with important areas such as food safety, these diseases that go back and forth between animals and people, proper use of antibiotics, emerging unique diseases like West Nile virus, and also responding to disasters. And I mentioned our combined DVM-MPH program, which is the largest in the nation. And in fact, the University of Minnesota trains more public health veterinarians than the rest of the nation combined. Our research programs really focus in three areas: comparative medicine, emerging zoonotic infectious diseases and population systems, and we clump them under one sort of overarching umbrella that we call One Science and One Medicine. The emerging and zoonotic diseases, these ones that go back and forth between animals and people, has long been an emphasis of the college, and this area of population systems that we include livestock health, ecosystem health, and food systems is a very growing, important area. And Dr. Levine talked about our National Center for Food Protection and Defense, and the three colleges that he mentioned are all working together with this national center really to help defend the nation's food supply. Our increased research funding has moved us up to fifth place in the nation amongst veterinary schools, and so we leverage this money, as Dean Durgan mentioned, to bring in other federal and private dollars. And these dollars are extremely important. They give us preliminary data that lets us compete for these larger federal grants, but it also lets us work on problems that are unique to the region and maybe there aren't competitive federal dollars available. Some of the projects that we've utilized the Agricultural Experiment Station funding and the Rapid Ag Response funding for have been these important, what I call production limiting and market limiting diseases. And so some of them have included diseases like avian metapneumovirus, porcine reproductive respiratory syndrome. You're all aware of the problem the state had with tuberculosis, diarrheal disease of cattle called Yoni's disease that may be a public health concern. And I'll just highlight a couple of these diseases, the avian metapneumovirus and the PRRS virus. These were both unknown conditions, and the university discovered the causative agents, developed tests, developed control programs, and develop vaccines to deal with these diseases. And the poultry industry will tell you that the avian metapneumovirus was costing them $15 million a year, and they'll now tell you that while the disease isn't eradicated, it's largely disappeared. The veterinary college is home to a number of important service units or business units. Probably the one that this group would be most familiar with is our Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. It's really the equivalent to the State Department of Health Laboratory for animals, but it is housed at the Veterinary College and rather than at a state government building. It's the official state laboratory for animal postmortems and other animal tests that are needed by animal owners and government officials of the state. We have a Center for Animal Health and Food Safety that does a lot of government contract work and puts out a lot of information sheets that can be very useful and informative around public health risks. We have a Raptor Center that many are familiar with that treats injured and diseased birds of prey, but more importantly, it uses those birds as a way to talk about environmental concerns, and they put on programs that reach over 200,000 people a year. Many of you may be familiar with our Veterinary Medical Center, our hospital that continues to be the busiest teaching hospital in the nation. And together with the Minnesota Extension Service, we put on a lot of extension and outreach programs. Many of them are aimed at professionals and veterinarians. We think of that as training the trainer, but many of them are also aimed at producers, and they focus on important areas like swine, dairy, poultry, public health, equine, as well as emerging areas like aquaculture. Well, I want to just finish by emphasizing or discussing a little bit more about our veterinary diagnostic lab. It performs 1.3 million tests a year, and most of these are for what are called production-limiting diseases like the PRRS virus I talked about or mastitis in dairy cattle. And so the lab runs tests that the producers and the veterinarians use every day to make management decisions about how they're going to handle these animals or treat these animals. But it also is the only accredited lab in the state, so it performs tests that the state Board of Animal Health requires in order to certify that we're free of disease and maintain markets, export markets. The state of Minnesota has export markets between 600 and 700 million in animals and animal products. The lab also supports the work of the Department of Natural Resources, so it does all the testing for viral hemorrhagic septicemia in freshwater fish, for chronic wasting disease and tuberculosis in deer, and the recent unfortunate announcement that we have it in our wild, chronic wasting disease in our wild deer, that testing was done at the diagnostic lab. We also support the Department of Health. We're the official electron microscope site for the Department of Health. And many of you may be aware of the problem with the pork plant workers in Austin, Minnesota, that had a neurologic condition. The Department of Health wanted to be sure that they hadn't contracted a swine disease. And they went to the National Veterinary Services Lab, run by USDA in Ames, Iowa, and asked if they could help. They said they couldn't, so they came to the veterinary college, to the diagnostic lab, and we ran 300 throat swabs and 300 serum samples and were able to confirm that the pork plant workers were not infected with any known swine pathogen. Fortunately, it turned out they had an autoimmune condition that many and most responded to, but it was good to hear that they had not contracted a disease from the pigs. So the diagnostic lab offers a full range of tests. They run these tests every day throughout the year, and they do this to support agriculture and to make sure that our food supply is safe. But I do want to tell you that the diagnostic lab does face a funding challenge. I believe that the location of the diagnostic lab within the university creates great synergies. It makes the lab and the university both more functional, but it creates some funding difficulties because of the two organizations involved. And the lab gets some of its funding from the university that supports the research and teaching that goes on. A lot of the research that I talked about with these large-scale population studies, that research is done in the diagnostic lab. So it's very synergistic in that way. But the lab gets additional funding through an agricultural state special that hasn't really been changed since the middle 90s. And there's been great inflationary pressures around salaries, around the reagents and test kits that are used, and around the facilities. We've had to add things like a chemical digester to deal with carcasses so that we don't have to worry about agents like chronic wasting disease or mad cow disease contaminating the environment. We've had to add a BSL-3 or high security postmortem facility so that if there should be the unfortunate situation of an avian influenza outbreak, that the state would be ready to deal with that. And so all this has greatly increased the financial pressures on the lab. The university has used some bridging money from stimulus funds to help support this. The college has been dipping into its reserves to support this, but this will not be possible in years to come, so we do need to find a sustainable model. So I'll just close by again thanking this committee for their help with the university, for providing the funds that are so vitally needed so that we can educate the workforce, protect agricultural production and provide research-based information. And I know the other deans would be happy to answer questions, even Dean Levine and his sore throat.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ames. We'll open it up for questions now. And Senator Rosen, I believe you have a question.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the first question is for Chair Durgan, and it had to do with the Horizons program. You said you're currently serving 34 rural towns, an 18-month program. Is there more information about where those communities are located, and how do you go about seeing the results and what they're done? And are the communities sharing their interaction, their game plan with other communities, or is it all just their own plan?
Dr.
A lot of
Durgan.
Questions on that horizon.
Chair, Senator, yes. The information on our Horizons program can be found on our website, so Extension's website, you could look at that. This is part of a larger multi-state program that is funded by the Northwest Area Foundation, so Montana, the Dakotas, Idaho, and Washington have also been part of this Horizons program. There has been a cohort of towns that we have worked with. Currently, not all 34 are at one time, so we've worked with them over a number of years. One of the recent ones I'm trying to remember was Starbuck, Minnesota, was one of the communities that we worked with. So you can find additional information on our website, or I'll be more than happy to send that information to you. And I think that he has left, but my Associate Dean Dick Sinise is that program is run out of his center. We'd be more than happy to come and work and come to talk to you about that.
And Mr. Chair, one more question.
Follow up.
Thank you. And Chair Levine, on the grants that have been given to the University of Minnesota, the state of Minnesota is $6 million. Are the renewable development funds, the RDF funds, is that included in this, or is that a completely different avenue?
Mr. Chair and Senator, no, I do not believe we have those included in those numbers. It's separate.
Mr. Chair, because I know a lot of those funds have been directed towards the biomass and the renewable,
right.
And of course they are for the renewable field, and so perhaps there is some information missing on that.
Yeah, I'll check.
Yeah,
on that.
Thank you,
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Ames. You answered part of my question when you addressed the vet shortage, but I was wondering if you had any suggestions for areas that we would call deep rural around here in terms of what they might be able to do to attract a vet. You know, I visited with the vet from Canby, and I think he's kind of at a point where he'd like to retire, but he hates to abandon his clients when there's not a replacement in line. So I just wondered if there were things that a community or a rural area could do to add some incentive to a vet coming their direction.
Dr. Ames?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, did you use the term deep rural? Was that the?
I did.
Okay. I'm originally from southern Saskatchewan, so I'm from a deep rural area myself, colder deep rural. These are sort of social challenges for rural America. It's not just the veterinary profession. It's all professions, getting them into smaller communities. I guess I'll refer to what other countries have done, and other communities in other countries, and so some communities have actually, you know, created a sort of a base funding package for veterinarians to work in a specific rural area, and where they give them sort of a base salary, and then they all farm calls have a set fee regardless of where you go in that area. It's not mileage dependent. Other countries use their what would be the equivalent of their USDA or Minnesota Department of Agriculture funds to provide base funding for the veterinarians to conduct what would be the regulatory work in the community. So that provides veterinarians out there as that surveillance network in deep rural areas. And in some ways, that's really what happened in the 50s and 60s, is the TB control programs and the brucellosis control programs that USDA had in place largely subsidized these veterinarians going into these rural areas, because they spent a lot of their time working on those control programs, and that provided kind of the base subsidy on their salaries so that then they could make a living by the additional work that they did in those communities. So those are a couple of suggestions or thoughts that I would put out there. There's other thoughts about, you know, training veterinarians as nurse practitioners so they would then be a community health worker for all species. So One Health, a true example of One Health. So there's a variety of suggestions about how we can have sustainable models in these communities.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to follow up there, Dr. Ames, I guess. I didn't take notes on that, but there were some good ideas. Would you mind putting that into an email and sending it to me?
No.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the three deans, thank you for coming with your presentation today. I've always been a strong supporter of the University of Minnesota, recognize the importance of research that you do for agriculture and the Extension Department in disseminating that important information. Members should remember that soybeans in the 50s were a relatively minor crop in Minnesota, and as we witnessed the last few weeks, they're a significant part of our ag economy now, and a lot of that is due to the research that was done at the University of Minnesota. But I do have two questions, maybe critiques and questions. The first is the University of Minnesota, from Norman Borlaug through Regent Professor Ron Phillips, has a long tradition of a premier plant genetics department. I am extremely worried about Minnesota's plant genetics department. There's been five or six significant retirements in that department. To my latest information, none of those positions have been filled. The savings have been absorbed back into the rest of the department. And Dean Levine, do you have any plans in the future to fill any or some of those plant genetics retirements that occurred in the last couple, 3 years?
Dr. Levine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, we would love to do it. We need to do it. The difficulty is that we had, as you know, two major cuts the past biennium and predicting the current. So what we've done is we've been in a hiring pause with plans to do some new hires as the funding permits. If we can get sufficient education funds and teaching programs, then we can hire those folks. It's the research component, because the salaries, to pay for those salaries, if we get the funds from USDA or NSF, they only pay summer salary. They don't pay the rest of the year's salary. So, yeah, of course, it's in our plans, because significant programs like that must continue.
Well, Dean Levine, you're making decisions by not making a decision. I understand there's financial constraints, but I would encourage you to do all you can do to fill those positions. Extremely important for Minnesota. And the other comment, question, I don't know who to direct this to, whoever would be helpful. I attended an invasive exotic species seminar in Detroit Lakes a couple weeks ago, and we have a real problem in Minnesota with exotic species, ranging from flowering rush to zebra mussels to Eurasian milfoil. The local folks in Detroit Lakes are funding research that they are paying for on their own. They have a food and beverage tax that they've instituted locally to pay for this. They're currently working with the University of Mississippi and the University in Idaho on this. And I'm extremely curious as to why they wouldn't be working with the University of Minnesota on this very important issue for Minnesota.
Doctors, whichever would prefer to respond.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know the answer to that question. We have hired recently somebody in invasive species. There's different invasive species. I haven't been informed that they were not working in that way, so I can check into that for you.
Mr. Chair and Dean Levine, I will encourage them again to contact the University of Minnesota, because I can't imagine that locally raised money for research shouldn't be being done at the University of Minnesota, which is significantly closer than Mississippi and Idaho.
Dr. Levine?
One more comment, Mr. Chair and Senator. As far as the funding and hiring new positions, when you say we make decisions by not making decisions, one of the reasons for that is our faculty that are tenured, I cannot just simply say to them, you leave and we're going to hire somebody in your place. So our flexibility around that area of doing targeted areas is less than you might think it would be otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dean. I appreciate that you are in challenging financial times. I will do all that I can do to help you in this area.
Senator Stumpf?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These are probably more comments than questions, but I think the big challenge that I see probably isn't a whole lot different than it was 10, 15 years ago, and that's funding. And but I think we have to think about how we might be able to come up with a different model, or a model that doesn't depend solely on the state, because I don't see big inflows of dollars from the state. And obviously the university does a great job in garnering federal dollars, but there are some important areas that the public is interested in, that there are dollars out there that could be rounded up, and I'm thinking along the lines of the issue that you mentioned relating to wasting disease. Wisconsin has it in their deer herd. Minnesota has it now identified in at least an A animal. It's a sportsmanship and hunting is a huge business. I think that possibly there would be money from 3/8 of a cent sales tax that goes into the Lessard, is it the Lessard Sam's or Sam's Lessard Council? The tourism and more and more people are using our parks. We've got many more incidences of West Nile and Lyme's disease. Somehow, I think if we get the type of research done to either develop vaccines or cures for some of these things, and I have confidence in the university that they can do it if they have the resources. You've done it in the past. And I think once we develop something, we have to figure out a way that we can derive some revenue for our higher education. And Senator Scoy mentioned soybeans. 30 years ago, we had no soybeans up in northern Minnesota. Now it's one of the most popular crops, and there's literally thousands and thousands of acres across northern Minnesota. Look at the profit that the farmers are making off of it. There's got to be a way that we can and I don't know if it's assess or, but we have to develop a system that some of those proceeds, when a cure is found, when something has been discovered, that can be plowed back into further research, hiring the best kinds of people that can solve the next problem. And I know there's been attempts like at patents and things like that, but we definitely have to push that pendulum out as far as we can go to get it'll not only help funding, but it'll help attract the most brilliant minds that will solve more problems. And I would like to see this legislature try to grapple with that somehow.
I'll open it up to the deans if you'd like to comment or respond to Senator Stump's comments. Any thoughts in that process?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, this is a partial response. So, but I did talk about our use of public-private partnerships to create these teaching farms where we can educate our students and do what we call population-scale research, you know, rather than the more traditional a few animals housed on campus research. And you need both. You need the small-scale studies to get the ideas to take into the populations. But what, you know, I guess I'm just echoing your comment that we have learned a lot by working in those public-private partnerships. We have faculty that are experts that get called in to consult on, you know, operations around the nation, and now they get to implement their own ideas. And it turns out that implementing your own ideas into an into an agricultural operation it's easier to make the recommendations. It's harder to be the one that's there and implements them and works them into the day-to-day operations. So we've learned a lot. It's made us a lot more creative, a lot more entrepreneurial by having to work with our private partners. We say it's like a marriage. You know, it takes work every day. But it does push us to be more creative and more responsive to the industry needs. So that's not an answer to your whole question. It doesn't certainly deal with some of the things you were talking about of looking for new funding streams, but it does open up new avenues. So within the Farm Bill, the federal Farm Bill, they passed specific language that said that there should be centers of excellence created for training food animal students, so that not every veterinary school would have to have the facilities for training every food animal student. And so, you know, I've sort of used this example in the past that it may be that Mississippi State is the best place to get training in catfish farming, and I think maybe we should be the place to come and get training in dairy medicine and swine medicine and public health and poultry. So I think we'd cover a lot of bases pretty well. And so, you know, because we have this farm, because it's such a wonderful facility, that now puts us in a position to compete for federal funding should it become available through the Farm Bill. So, again, not a full answer, but just a partial response to what you brought up.
Thank you. Senator Nelt, excuse me, follow up.
Just two small areas that the university has a great food science processing capacity. They make excellent cheese. They make good sausage. You know, here's the challenge. We have these Asian carp that are encroaching up to Minnesota.
I like it.
They multiply like I don't think any other fish or species. Why can't we develop a good tasting meal out of these Asian carp? I mean, it's something that could turn an invasive species into a heck of a profit. And another one is poison ivy. I don't know. It's all over our parks across the state. And people are allergic to that. There used to be, a number of years ago, there used to be a kind of like a vaccine or something. You could get a shot from the doctor. They don't do it, I guess, anymore. But if we had a way, deer go and they eat this poison ivy, they don't get irritated from it. You know, why couldn't we figure out a way to protect our campers and our children who go out into the woods in these parks from getting that poison ivy? I mean, there's kind of applications you can put on, but I mean, those are just a couple things that you could literally turn millions of people in favor of something.
Dr. Levine.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I was department head of food science and nutrition. We never really talked about those two issues, so I think you should come over and give a little seminar, and we'll get that going. No, those are interesting ideas in terms of taking crops that we don't use and turn them into food products. I also wanted to follow up and say that another source of funds are endowment funds, and we have a good number of endowed professors across the university. At a 4.5%, a million isn't enough anymore, so we have to ask for a $3 million endowment. But we do a lot of development work. We work with a lot of givers, and we've been very fortunate in having corporate plus private giving that has endowed a series of chairs in our college. So that's another source. We're always thinking, all of us, we're not sitting silently and not thinking about this. We discuss it continually.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick comments in regards to Senator Scoyne, Senator Stump's line of thinking, and then a question for Dean Durgan. The comments about the challenge of getting the right people really in the right places and some of the maybe legacy constraints you have in doing that reminds me of a discussion that Dean Durgan and I had when I was on the Citizens Advisory Council for Extension. So I hope we're making progress on that. But I understand it's an ongoing issue. And then Senator Stump's idea about let's make some profits for higher education that we can plow back into higher education. Refresh my memory. Do we have an Office of Commercialization to look at things like the Tango apple or the barley that you were developing when I was there last? And actually taking those things that go onto the market then and having some sort of patent or way to take those funds and get them back into the university.
Dr. Durgan.
Chair and Senator Nelson, it's nice seeing you again. A follow-up on also with Senator Scoy is that currently University of Minnesota Extension has four joint faculty positions with North Dakota State University. So it's one way of trying to leverage our funding across state lines. As you know, North Dakota seems to have much more money than we do right now. So those joint appointments work very well. But they also are they are jointly with industry. So two of those positions are sugar beet positions. The sugar beet growers provide all the support for those positions. So it is a public and private partnership. I'm on my way to NDSU next week to talk about a joint program in wheat breeding with NDSU and how we can work across with wheat breeding and winter wheat breeding. So again, to try to fill some of those gaps that both of our states need to be able to do that. And to follow up on your question, Senator Nelson, we do have an Office of Technology and commercialization. All of the varieties that we release now, whether they're public varieties or our licensed varieties, that we do we do generate royalties with those. So RB07, Quest Barley, there is a per bushel charge on the certified seed that goes back into a fund then that supports the wheat development. And that money is used then for all the seed increases and also for graduate students. So we are generating that. We also are, within our hort varieties, we are either patenting or trademarking all of those releases. So I don't know if any of you have seen our latest rose releases, Swen, Oli, and Lena. I don't get to name those. But they are really taking over the marketplace because of our winter hardiness. So all of those do have royalties. You know, and so all of those are adding to the additional work that we do. And it is something that we think about all the time with releasing varieties. And also within Extension, though we haven't talked about it yet here today, is that almost all of our Extension programs do charge fees. So we have increased the amount of money that we've received in Extension from fees, contracts, and gifts. That's now over 20% of our budget, where it wasn't before. So, you know, we're actively looking for those other funds to support those programs, and we have the same concern you do, is that if these programs are going to continue, we need to find other sources of funding and look for new partners and ways that we could bring additional money to bear on some of these problems.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Yes.
Thank you. So, and my comment would be, I hope that the royalties that we're charging are competitive. I mean, they certainly want to be competitive, but look at, do they need to be increased more? And the same way with the cost on the courses that are being offered, does it reflect the cost of offering those courses? But my real question that I really would like some information on is the Ag State Special. And I'm looking at the graph that shows the funding on page 3. And I think this is obviously very important. I know it's very important to my district as well as the state. And I'm a little bit confused on the projected funding. Some have said that the Ag Special got a disproportionate cut or a disproportionate funding decrease in 2010 and 11. And then, of course, because we're looking at just making those one-time reductions permanent, that disproportionate reduction is going to continue on. But then others have said that is not the case. So I'd like to get your background on the history of the proportionality or the disproportionality of the funding for the Ag State Special.
Chair and Senator Nelson, the funding, the budget that I have given you there that reflects the Ag State Special is that the last chart reflects the funding that is that we are currently in with the unallotments that we received last year and projected into next year if those unallotments were not maintained. So at the with the end of the legislative session last year, through some unallotments within the legislature and the governor, the Ag State Special was reduced 12.7%, and that was and as you mentioned, it was a higher rate than the overall university's budget was, but that was an unallotment within all the state specials within the university, not just the Ag State Special. So you are correct, and that is the reflection of those decreases as they stand right now.
Just a comment. Actually, I misspoke. I used the word unallotment, and I ought not have, because, frankly, the cuts were voted on by the legislature. So it wasn't an unallotment. It was the decision of the legislature. But the point that I wanted to make was, so it was a disproportionate reduction by the legislature of 12.7%. Is that correct?
Senator Chair, Senator Nelson, yes. So those reductions were voted on, and it's relative. It was greater than the overall reduction of what the university did receive.
That's what I was getting at. All right, thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator.
Mr. Chair.
One of the reasons you might have been confused is that the university, and you might hear from some folks, that not all the units got that level of cut because the university helped reinforce that by sending extra funds. So in the agricultural experiment station, that was because it was considered a service unit. In the colleges that receive those state special funds, they were not cut to that level. Even though the state cut it, the university, and who knows if that can continue.
Clarification, Chair and Senator Nelson, is that the we are all funded by Ag State Special dollars and also O&M dollars from within the university. And what Dean Levine was just talking about, though the Ag State Special dollars were cut, the university did provide some additional funding in O&M to smooth those reductions. So the experiment station did receive 12.7. The whole Ag State Special was cut that. But for an extension, for example, the university did provide additional O&M funds to help, soften that blow of that cut.
Thank you.
And names?
I just wanted to make the point that the veterinary diagnostic lab is also a state special, so it was also reduced to 12.7%.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Kielash?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions, some of it has been answered, but one of my questions is just how much money do we take in with the royalties and from what has been already released by the university? Is there a dollar figure on that for the wheat, the Honeycrisps, all the other apples that the university gets, or does that go directly to your departments? The other question.
Dean Durkin.
Chair, Senator, we can get you the full dollar amount of royalties. Generally, their patents sound nice, but not all of them generate, a lot of money. But, for example, with Honeycrisp, which is one that was not patented, what was licensed, that it that That license has created the most revenue of any of our releases within the Agricultural Experiment Station. To date, it's about $8 million. And that is distributed based on a formula. Some of it goes back to support central administration and technology transfer. Then the rest is divided through with the inventor to the colleges and also back to the unit where the inventor invented that. So it's distributed that way. So Honeycrisp was a big hit. The biggest royalty at the University of Minnesota was generated within the Academic Health Center. Was
it's an AIDS.
An AIDS drug. So there's a number of patents. Not all of them are big money generators like we would hope they would be.
Thank you. And can I follow? One of the other questions I had that Dr. Levine was talking about is that the local foods or organic foods is a growing industry. One of the things that I see with the research, and I've heard some other folks talk about, is that the research has been primarily at the U on commodity crops, the soybeans, corn, et cetera. Are we doing anything on foodstuffs and vegetable crops or something? Because we spend a lot of money outside the state for food, and with rising energy costs and local foods becomes more competitive. And we're running into a place where there's a lot of demand for it, but in order for it to be a good generator for the state, I think it needs to grow a little bit more. And if you have any ideas or if there's research being done on that, I'd appreciate that too.
Dean Levine.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we have research in the Horticultural Sciences Department around specialty crops. Mm-hmm. We also have high tunnel systems to look at things like ginger out of Waseca. So, yes, we are, in fact, doing some of that kind of work now and submitting grants in that area as well.
Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean Levine, I'll send this one to you. And this is with the backdrop of the fact that we still are dependent on oil and will be for a long time because it doesn't look like we're going to run out of it anytime really soon. But we've got ethanol going, and you know, that's for food versus fuel. I'm wondering if our second and third generation of ethanol, cellulosic biofuels, those types of things, if we're doing there's lots of R&D work being done outside the universities. Do we have anything in particular that we're working on?
Dr. Levine.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we, in fact, that's what I was talking about when I was talking about the lignocellulose work in the woody plants. We're attempting to break down that lignin and to make fuels from that as well. We are also working with algae, as I mentioned before, in terms of biodiesel. So the next gen, we are working in different areas around that. And the College of Biological Sciences is also working on varieties of algae that have higher lipid content. So we're making an attempt in a serious way by hiring some faculty. Those hires were made prior to all these cuts.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Dean Levine, do you get any private industry to buy into that type of research?
Dean Levine. I mean,
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, some of our investigators work directly with some of the paper plants on utilizing energy with that industry. So there are industry influence as well with our engineering group.
Very good. Thank you.
Any other questions by any other senators for our panel of guests from the university? If not, I'd like to thank Dr. Ames, Dean of your college, and Dr. Durgan and Dr. Levine, Dean of your respective colleges, for coming in today and for your testimony. Thank you very much. We look forward to working with you in the future, and so we appreciate that. The Committee on Agriculture and Rural Economics, next week we'll talk about the updates and trends in Minnesota horse industry, Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, and the Cooperative Network and Farm Credit Services. If there are no other questions to come before the committee, I'll call the committee adjourned. The Committee of Agriculture and Rural Economics is adjourned.